Well, thank you very much for being here, and it's a pleasure to see so many people here on a Friday. And at this stage in the term, when exams are beginning to appear rapidly on the horizon, it's a great pleasure not only to welcome you here, but for me it's a very great pleasure and an honor to recommend Bob Cohan. I actually only learnt just now that you don't pronounce the E. I've always said Bob Keohane or Cohane. And fortunately, in the emails, and he doesn't know that I didn't know you didn't pronounce the E, but it's Bob Cohan. He is James D. Duke, Professor of Political Science at Duke University, and he's been interested for a very long time in the role played by governance in world politics, and in particular, how international institutions and transnational networks operate. He's the author, to say the least, of a number of very, very influential books. After Hegemony, published in 1984, which was certainly a milestone in political science and international relations theory, International Institutions and State Power, Power and Independence, World Politics and Transition, and many other works, and I shall come on to the forthcoming ones in a moment. Between 1974 and 1980, he was editor of the distinguished journal International Organization. He's been president of the International Studies Association, and most recently president of the American Political Science Association, 1999 to 2000. His very important address, Governance in a Partially Globalized World, appeared in the American Political Science Review, March 2001. Most recently, he's the author of Power and Governance in a Partially Globalized World, the book, which will be published in September by Routledge, and he's the co-editor of Humanitarian Intervention, Ethical, Legal, and Political Dilemmas, Cambridge University Press, forthcoming in a couple of years, Bob?
Next year.
Well, it's hard to understate how significant Robert Cohan's contribution has been. And of course, there are, as a social scientist, we could develop a number of empirical indicators of this and qualitative indicators of this. Well, the empirical indicators would be things like the citation index, which would show, of course, that he's widely quoted, widely referred to in academic literature all over the world. But there's a moment when I had to say something about how important and significant his work was, which happened to me 35,000 feet up over Chicago a few years ago. I was flying with the British Airways over somewhere over the Chicago. It was a very pleasant flight. And suddenly, the weather turned, and we found ourselves in a thunderstorm. And the turbulence was violent and extreme, to say the least. Now, throughout my whole journey, I'd been reading two books. I'd been reading After Hegemony, and I'd been reading one chapter of that, and then I'd be switching it to Bob Dahl's Democracy and Its Critics and reading a chapter of that. And that's how it went for several hours. But my neighbors on my right were reading the Bible. They were Mormons, and they'd been reading the Bible more or less the whole time. When the storm hit and the turbulence started, everybody went back to their seatbelts, seatbelt signs went on, the crew were anxious to get everyone in their seats, of course. But the two Mormons got out of their seats, into the aisle, and kneeled down. Now, this caused absolute panic, of course. Not that the plane was going to fall out of the sky, but that they might, you know, fall out from where they were. So the crew rushed to get them in their seats, and they didn't shift. They would not shift. Soon, we were out of the turbulence, out of the storm, and the two people on their knees looked very smug indeed. You know, clearly there was a causal relationship between the practice of praying at that moment and the plane moving safely through the storm. And they came back and sat next to me. And they saw that I was still reading. I was trying to pretend I wasn't at all perturbed by the storm and was carrying on reading. And they looked at me, and the woman said to me, "What are you reading?" So I said, "I'm reading actually two books." And I meant, "Well, this one is Bob Cohan's book, After Germany." And she said, She said, "Is this an influential book?" I sort of paused for a moment and said, "Yes, I think it's a very influential book, very influential in American political science circles, American policy circles in Washington, not influential enough now. We could use a bit more of that influence now." And I said, "You know, fairly influential around the world." And she paused for a minute and she said, "My book is very, very influential." And then she said, "Well, how important is it? How important is this contribution?" So I gave a version of the first answer, which I won't repeat again now. I said, "You know, very important. It's made a very significant contribution." I said, "Would you like me to explain it in the context?" "Oh, no, no, no." And she said, "My book is very, very important, and it's been very important all over the world." So pause for a moment, and I hope that was the end of the conversation. And then she turned to me and she said, "Well, is your book true?" Now, if you ask any social scientist that question, you know what we're going to say. We're going to say, "Oh, I really like page 24. I'm not so sure about page 73. I like the quotes on page 120, but I'm not entirely sure about the way he concludes on page 139. So I said, I paused for a minute and said, "Well, you know, as social science books go, definitely." And she said, "Well, my book is true. It's the truth." So I paused for a moment, thinking, "Well, maybe we've just finished that." You know, she's established that the Bible is the truth, and my book is, you know, more or less true. And but it didn't stop. There was one final question, and she said, "But is your book is it the Word of God?" So, important, yes. Influential, yes. True, more or less, give or take some qualifications. The Word of God, I had to concede defeat. I resisted, of course, saying, you know, what one could always say, "Well, are you sure about the authorship of your book?" I didn't say that. But it's certainly established in qualitative terms in this deliberative discourse, influential, important, mighty significant, but short of the Word of God. And it's we're very pleased to have you here to talk today to the theme, slightly different from the advertised one, but similar in broadly speaking, global governance and democratic accountability after 9/11. So please welcome warmly Robert Cohen.
Well, that's a lovely introduction. I think it's the best I've ever had, and the best defense against the toughest competition I've ever faced. I mean, I'll never worry about Ken Waltz again. it's a great pleasure to be here at LSE. I spent some time here 23 years ago when I was in England for the summer, and so whenever I'm here, I always think of my dear friend Susan Strange, who was here then, and some of you may have known. Those of you who only read what Susan said about my work might think we were deadly enemies, because I don't think she liked any of it. I don't even think she liked the quality of the paper that After Germany was printed on. But she and I were very good friends, and I loved her, so I miss her not being here. This is a talk at the beginning of a conference which some of us are having. Going to continue after the lecture on accountability, and it's a pleasure to see a number of my colleagues at the conference. But it's a little bit daunting because a number of them have written on accountability, and it reminds me of a story, apocryphal, of course, as you will see, and probably your Mormon friend wouldn't like this story, the story is of a man who lived in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which had an enormous flood, a famous flood in I think 1877. This man was rather a bore, and his only interesting experience in his 65 years of life was to have almost been drowned in the Johnstown flood. And it's the only thing he could talk about. So when he finally, but apparently he wasn't a bad person, because when he finally died and went to heaven, he was greeted at the pearly gates by St. Peter. And St. Peter said, "You know, I don't know if you know this, but in heaven we have a custom that newcomers get every afternoon to say a few words about their lives." And the man said, "Oh, I'll talk about the Johnstown flood." And he went on and on about this. And Peter, his eyes were glazing over. And after a minute, Peter said, "That's all very well. You can talk about what you want to talk about. But don't forget, Noah's in the audience." So I feel with Fritz Sharp and Gary Woods, Calypso Nicolaitis, David Held, and others that Noah's in the audience here. But I will go ahead anyway. My topic might appear to be an optimistic one: global governance and democratic accountability. Liberals like myself are sometimes characterized as optimists, and in some respects we are, because we believe that people are capable of improving their social and political situations. But liberals who have survived the second half of the 20th century are quite capable of pessimism. And in my analysis of accountability and global governance, you will find a mixture of both optimism and pessimism. Let me outline the structure of this lecture. Part one briefly discusses the concept of democratic accountability and the concept of global governance. In part two, I will contrast the universal global society, my phrase, of pre-9/11 imaginations with the reality that global society only exists within an international and transnational system without universally accepted values and institutions. In particular, we need to take malign agency more seriously than we've taken it in the global governance field. Part three discusses the various entities that we might want to hold accountable in some system of accountability and how to do this. And contrary, this is probably the most controversial part of the talk, contrary to what one might believe on the basis of most writing on the subject, in my view, intergovernmental organizations, along with weak states, seem among the most accountable agencies, entities in world politics. NGOs, corporations, religious organizations and movements, terrorist networks, and powerful states are, in my view, much less accountable. If we believe in accountability, as I do, we need to pay more attention, especially to states. How can powerful states, the United States in particular, be held more accountable in world politics? So in other words, I think much of literature has been chasing the hares down the path when the deer or the wolves have been running the other way without much pursuit. So first, let me talk about the concepts, accountability, governance, and what I call the accountability gap. An accountability relationship is one in which an individual, group, or other entity makes demands on an agent to report on his or her activities, and in which this group has or entity has the ability to impose costs on the agent. So it involves both information and sanctions. We can speak of an authorized or institutionalized accountability relationship when the requirement to report and the right to sanction are mutually understood and accepted. Other accountability relationships are more contested. That is, not all accountability relationships are authorized and institutionalized. In such situations, certain individuals, groups, or entities claim the right to hold agents accountable, but the agents do not recognize a corresponding obligation. It's an important distinction between authorized and institutionalized accountability relationships, such as the accountability of the General Accounting Office to Congress in the United States, or the accountability of the Prime Minister in question time to the House of Commons, and an unauthorized or non-institutionalized relationship, such as the purported accountability, or there should be accountability, some people think, of the World Bank or IBM to people who are affected by their actions. I refer to the actor holding an agent accountable as a principal, using the principal-agent language, when the accountability relationship is institutionalized. When the relationship is not institutionalized, I refer to the actor seeking to hold someone else accountable as a would-be principal, to make that distinction. And much of the politics of accountability actually involves struggles over who should be accepted as a principal. And I'll go into that in some more detail. So it's very misleading to take as unproblematic the principal-agent relationship as if it were given. Democratic accountability now, within a constitutional system, is a relationship in which power wielders are accountable to broad publics. There's some mechanism to hold power wielders accountable to a broad public. Democratic accountability in world politics could be conceived of as a hypothetical system in which agents whose actions made a sufficiently great impact on the lives of people in other societies would have to report to those people and be subject to sanctions from them. It's a hypothetical system. There is no such system in existence. But accountability need not be democratic, and that's another distinction that's important to make. Indeed, it can also be hierarchic, in which subordinates are accountable to superiors. Some of you presumably are research assistants, and you're accountable to your professors, whether you like it or not. And that's not democratic in the least. It's hierarchic. And accountability can also be pluralistic or horizontal, as in a Madisonian constitutionalism, in which different independent entities are accountable to each other. The president is accountable to Congress, but neither is superior to the other in structure. So actual systems of accountability in constitutional systems combine all three syndromes of accountability: democratic, hierarchic, and pluralistic. And they rely on a number of different mechanisms, not just on hierarchy and elections. They also rely on horizontal accountability, checks and balances in the American sense, fiscal and legal controls, peer review, markets, and general concerns about reputation. So we have to think about a whole number of mechanisms of accountability, not just elections or some sort of command structure. Now, governance can be defined as the making and implementation of rules and the exercise of power within a given domain of activity. So global governance refers to rulemaking and power exercise at a global scale, though not necessarily by entities authorized by general agreement to act. Global governance is exercised by states, by the Roman Catholic Church, by business corporations like IBM or ExxonMobil, which is next door, as well as by intergovernmental and non-governmental organizations. And they act in a strategic set of relationships with each other. As you know, most of this is non-authorized, it's non-institutionalized. And only a small part of it is institutionalized. So some degree, I believe, of democratic and pluralistic accountability is essential to the legitimacy of global governance, but we haven't yet devised a system which actually constructs that form of accountability in a systematic way. And that's the problem that I want to raise. Now, normatively, then, from the perspective of democratic theory, Robert Dahl's Democracy and Its Critics books that David was reading on this ill-fated airplane flight, what justifies demands that an agent could be held accountable by some person or group? What would make it reasonable for you to say that you could hold me accountable for something? And I think there are three kinds of justifications that are commonly brought forward. One, which is Hobbes's justification, is authorization. That is, Hobbes emphasized that the process by which one entity authorizes another to act may confer rights on the authorizer and obligations on the agent. So if for some reason I authorize you to act on my behalf, then it's reasonable to expect that you're accountable to me in some sense. Secondly, there's support. Those who provide financial or political support to a ruler have a claim to hold the ruler accountable. So in an electoral system, the voters have a claim to hold the ruler accountable, even if they haven't originally authorized the system. And taxpayers have a right to hold the spenders of their money accountable. As in the American Revolution, there's a basic democratic claim, no taxation without representation. And thirdly, and this is the most difficult one, is impact. It's often argued, as our host David Held has said, quote, that those who are choice determining for some people should be fully accountable for their actions. Now, authorization and support are the easy ones. They're the basis for what I call, and I'm sorry for all the distinctions, but this is the most important distinction of the lecture, they're the basis for what I call internal accountability, accountability within a structure, within an institutionalized organization. They create capabilities to hold entities accountable because the principal is providing legitimacy or financial resources to the agent. And this is internal accountability because the principal and the agent are institutionally linked to one another. So since providing authorization and support create means of influence, then this influence can be used to close any accountability gap. The accountability gaps internally, I think, are less severe than externally because the principal to whom the agent is held accountable is also providing support and authorization and can withdraw the support or withhold the support if accountability is not forthcoming. So that's the classic democratic accountability, internal accountability. And it's also the accountability you find inside organizations, inside firms, and so on. It's not always democratic. Now, the more serious normative problems arise with respect to what I call external accountability. That is, accountability to people outside the actor, outside the acting entity, outside the agent, whose lives are, or the would-be agent, whose lives are affected by it. For example, consider Asians and Africans affected by U.S. foreign policy in the last six months. Undoubtedly, they've been affected by U.S. foreign policy. So on the impact criterion, one might think they should be able to hold the United States accountable, but there's no mechanism by which they can do so. The normative question arises, should the acting entity, be accountable to the set of people it affects? It's not obvious, because if I were accountable to everyone whom I affected, that would be the whole world in a certain sense, right? Every time I take a ride on jet aircraft, I have some impact on raising the price of petrol, and therefore one might want to hold me accountable for that, but it's going to be quite an absurdity if we're all held accountable to everybody for everything. So in a very interdependent context, also an organization which has more impact than I do on the price of petrol is going to have impacts on all of us many times. And so it won't do to say that anybody who's affected has the right to hold accountable anyone who affects them. You can think for a minute as what sort of chaos that would provide. But it won't also do either to say that only those people inside the organization or inside the state have a right to hold it accountable if it's having a huge impact on others. So there's somehow we have to try to figure out this problem. And I'm going to this is I'm going to leave this. There must be a number of normative political theorists in this room, in addition to David. And I'm going to leave this question to you. But I think it's an important question. And as far as I know, there has been no really definitive assessment of it in the political theory literature. Maybe if there has been, I'd like to hear about it. I think it's a problem that political philosophers ought to address. That is, to what extent, in an interdependent world, does the fact that people are affected deeply by the actions of entities of which they are not a part, give them a valid claim to hold those entities accountable? And under what conditions, and what should that accountability consist? Now, if we were to make a judgment that a group affected by some set of actions has a valid claim, then we can ask the empirical question, can it effectively demand the accountability that it deserves? And we have accountability gaps if we have a disjunction or a gap between the normative answer that we give and the empirical one. That is, if we discover that we believe that a certain set of people, let us say poor people whose houses are going to be flooded by a dam, this would be 15 years ago. The World Bank doesn't build dams anymore, but 15 years ago it built dams. The World Bank supplied funding for dams, and the claim was made, which I would have accepted, that people who are going to be flooded out of house and home by a World Bank dam have some claim on the World Bank to hold it accountable for its policies. And then if we discovered that they had no ability to make that claim good, they had no way to hold the World Bank accountable, then we would see an accountability gap. And I'm concerned in this lecture with external accountability gaps and how they might be closed. Now, a premise of my talk is that rulers hate being held accountable. They may not say so, but I think rulers dislike being held accountable. They may often have reasons to submit to accountability mechanisms. In a democratic system, accountability may be essential to maintain the confidence of the public. And in any system, some degree of accountability may be necessary to maintain the credibility of the agent. That is, other dimensions of power may be more important to the ruler than lack of accountability. But we can expect power holders to seek to avoid accountability when they can do so without jeopardizing other goals. That's a fundamental premise of this talk. And therefore, in the absence of a constitutional system, the ability to avoid being held externally accountable is one dimension of power. Point is that accountability is a power term. And much of the literature on accountability doesn't mention power, and that seems to me to be a very bad mistake. Because to talk about accountability without focusing on power would be like discussing the motivations of corporate chieftains without mentioning money. All right, now let me turn then to the second part of the talk, which is about system and society in a world of fragmented order. And then I'll get to the heart of the talk later, which is the accountability discussion. I think it's useful in thinking about accountability at a global level to begin with Hedley Bull's discussion and distinction between a system and a society. I'm going to use it a little differently than Bull, but the states in an international society for Bull are, in his words, quote, conscious of certain common interests and common values. That's a society. But and quote, share in the workings of common institutions. But the states in an international system do not. And Bull's example of a system that's not a society is Christianity in the Ottoman Empire in the 16th, 17th centuries, where they, in fact, interacted extensively, but they did not share common values. They enslaved one another when they could, unlike the way the Christian states treated other Christian states. They fought with them, but they had a common set of codes and institutions. Now, much writing on globalization seems to me to imagine that a universal global society has emerged, and I don't think it has. And the assumptions go like this. Globalization is viewed as the intensification of interdependence at a global level, or even as a process, the words of one of the papers for this conference, beyond interdependence. The global society is seen as not merely international, but transnational. Secondly, interests among groups are seen, as they're seen in my book, After Hegemony, as often conflicting, but also complementary. They're not zero-sum interests. Thirdly, people worldwide are seen as having similar aspirations linked to the benefits of prosperity and freedom. As my friend and colleague Joan Ice says, soft power accrues to those societies whose institutions and practices are seen as worthy of emulation. Others want to copy them or want to copy us. And finally, democratic values in this vision are seen as spreading, based on the assumption that aspirations both for material benefits and recognition are best met in democratic settings. Now, certain arguments about governance follow from this, I think it's an imagined world. I don't think it's a real world. It's an imagined world of universal global society where everyone has these features. And there are, in fact, in this sense, common institutions and common values. Consider, for example, David Held's very sophisticated recent discussion of three models of sovereignty, which some of you may have read, classic, liberal, and cosmopolitan. For David, there's been a movement over the past century from classic to liberal sovereignty. In liberal conception of sovereignty, legitimacy is not conferred automatically by control. Indeed, institutions that limit state authority have been developed. And moving beyond liberal sovereignty, Held envisages a prospective movement to cosmopolitan law and governance. It hasn't happened yet, but he hopes it's on the way. Multi-level governance, including governance at a global level, will be, in his words, quote, shaped and formed by an overarching cosmopolitan legal framework, unquote. And this is an attractive vision. It's a non-utopian vision. Consider my own sketch, which he referred to, written 2 years ago, of global institutions designed with self-interest and threats of tyranny in mind to create, in my words, working institutions for a polity of unprecedented size and diversity. I was somewhat more cautious than David was, but was fundamentally optimistic in cosmopolitan. Or finally, consider Anne-Marie Slaughter's paper for this conference, which envisages the creation of a global public space. Now, sensible analysts with these visions recognize the difficulties they would encounter in implementation, even in a universal global society, such as Saudi lacks a strong civil society with robust communication patterns. The political resources at a global level to aggregate fragmented interests, especially the lack of political party systems, means that it's very hard to aggregate those interests. And the very size of a global polity would create immense incentive problems for voters. That is, rational ignorance would prevail. It wouldn't make much sense to pay attention if you're only one vote out of 6 billion. As a result, sophisticated proponents of global governance do not rely exclusively on electoral accountability. If globalization of public authority occurred, individual citizens would have few incentives to try to monitor government's behavior. On the capacity side, it would be hard without political parties or a coherent civil society to aggregate interests and coherently articulate claims. And so we see these difficulties in the European Union, which is a highly favorable situation for democratic accountability with common democratic values in democratic institutions. And there's significant accountability in the EU, but not at the level of a well-functioning democracy. So cosmopolitan democracy will not be based on the domestic analogy. Nevertheless, to many observers, at least through 9/11, it has seemed reasonable to work incrementally in that direction by diffusing political authority and forms of governance, or by disaggregating sovereignty, to cite David Held and Anne-Marie Slaughter. 9/11 has, in my view, made this view of the world seem much too sanguine. Terrorists have brought coercion back into our lives with a vengeance, and the security-seeking, violence-wielding state has not been far behind. We therefore need to craft a more sober and complex view of the world. An increasingly globalized world society exists within a violence-prone system, which is both international and transnational. The world is not neatly divided into zones of peace or areas, in my phrase, with nigh of complex interdependence and realism. Relationships of peaceful exchange among societies and violent conflict involving non-state actors can occur in the same physical space. That's new. They're occurring in the same physical space. After 9/11, we can most readily then see the flaws in the vision of a universal global society. People in this imaginary world are at worst indifferent to the fate of others. The worst thing you can be is not care about the poor, about inequality. Hatred, nurtured and sustained by communities built around ideologies, is absent from this imaginary world. Missing is the malign agency of the airplane assassins and those millions of people who cheered their evil deeds. But the reality is that people in the real world do not fully share common values. The Taliban did not try to emulate the social organization of Western society, and in fact rejected much of it, in particular the practice of enabling women to lead public lives. Many fundamentalist religious people of various denominations do not share, indeed reject, secular ideals such as that of pluralist democracy. David was a little bit afraid to raise certain secular issues with his Mormon friends for fear this would be lead to a long sermon for the rest of the trip. He was quite sure they didn't share common values and common institutions. Indeed, one reason that democratic values are not spreading universally is that dogmatic religions, claiming exclusive access to ultimate truth, contain fundamentally anti-democratic elements. They appeal for authority not to human experience, science, or public opinion, but to established authority or privileged knowledge of the divine. And they reject accountability to publics and the human institutions. Since they interpret the divine, they are accountable really only to themselves. Insofar as people seek recognition and self-esteem through such religions as opposed to through democracy, they will not be drawn toward liberal democracy. The notion that we're all moving toward liberal democracy a la Fukuyama, and therefore that everybody wants to emulate us, is surely a fairy tale. We must unfortunately conclude that the vision of a universal global society is a mirage. Society is indeed global. Common values and common institutions are not geographically bounded. We can find people with similar values probably in every country of the world and among every religion of the world. But global society is not universal. It does not include Al-Qaeda, does not include suicide bombers, and it does not include substantial elements of the populations of U.S. allies such as Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. In the absence of a universal global society, cosmopolitan democracy is very unlikely on a global scale. And after 9/11, I think we should see this more clearly. Yet governments have a responsibility to provide order and a feeling of security. Externally, Western states have substantial power resources, military, economic, and the soft power of having a lot of people want to be like us. Internally, states will tighten control of their borders, and already are, and surveillance of people within those borders. I understand that in London, when you walk down the street, you're being photographed automatically. Isn't that right? I mean, I've had my picture taken many times in the last day, I think. So much the worse for the cameras. But the overall result, then, will be a system in Bull's sense. Globalization, implying a high level of interdependence, will continue. But no set of common institutions and common values will be universally accepted. Global society will not be universal, but rather partial. It will exist within the context of a broader international and transnational system, which states and non-state actors will both play a crucial role, and in which the state is obviously being revived in a variety of respects. What will the society within a state system look like? Of course, we don't know. Anything said on the subject is speculative. But I want to note five features of the society within system that I think can be suggested. One, large parts of the world will remain in the imagined global society of pre-9/11 days. Indeed, some parts of the world formerly outside this society, such as China and Russia, may well move into it, even at an accelerated rate in response to terrorist acts. Within this sphere, complex interdependence, nice in my phrase, and soft power will remain important. I'm not at all denying that. Secondly, the fundamental values of substantial populations, however, will be antithetical to one another, especially wherever fundamentalist versions of exclusivist, messianic, religions prevail in one society. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are all subject to such interpretations. People who believe that their doctrines alone represent revealed truth have often in history been ill-disposed toward people with different beliefs. That's an understatement. And the present seems no exception. Relatively few societies now are dominated by people professing such beliefs, but there's a danger that the number of such societies will increase. Between societies dominated by such people and democratic societies, there will not be a common global society, only a system of interactions. Thirdly, force will continue to be fragmented, controlled mostly by states, but sometimes in the hands of smaller groups that need not control large amounts of contiguous territory to wield force. Fourth, within the partial international society, the world of complex interdependence, progress toward the cosmopolitan ideal may very well occur. Common rules and practices will develop on the basis of procedural agreement, as suggested by Habermas and Rawls. But finally, in the wider world, the cosmopolitan ideal will be unrealistic even as an ideal. Coercion and bargaining will be the chief means of influence, not persuasion and emulation. Hence, the state will remain a central actor. It's not banishing, folks. Power will not be diffused. Furthermore, territoriality may well be strengthened. It's being strengthened right now. All this talk about territoriality vanishing doesn't look very good after 9/11. Especially if you travel in the United States, just tell me how much territoriality is vanishing, especially if you have the misfortune to look as if you're of Arab origin. For instance, we are now seeing strong pressures to reestablish border controls, as you know, even in Western Europe. And now let me turn to the question of, with this context, of accountability within the system and the society that I'm talking about. I'm going to grab a little bit of water. The mixed society within system that I'm projecting yields mixed implications for accountability. Internal accountability will be strong, at least in democratic countries, but external accountability will be weak. That's the basic theme of the next 20 minutes. It almost goes without saying that where conflicts of interest are pronounced, powerful states will not let themselves be held accountable to their adversaries. The United States is not going to be held accountable for its anti-terrorism tactics to al-Qaeda. Even though al-Qaeda is affected by it, they could claim on the basis of being affected some demand of accountability. That's not going to be listened to. And it's also, and vice versa as well. It is also true that asymmetries of power attenuate accountability. Europe is not going to be held accountable for its immigration policies to the countries of origin of would-be immigrants. Only when the countries have interest in holding others accountable, as in trade policies or in the WTO, are powerful states disposed to at least consider letting themselves be held accountable. Powerful states let themselves be held accountable when they get something out of it. Yet demands for external accountability will continue to be made against states, intergovernmental organizations, corporations, and other entities viewed as powerful. These demands will largely be made by non-state actors, NGOs in the parlance, non-governmental organizations, and advocacy networks. So I speak of transnational accountability. Meeting these demands to some extent will be essential to the legitimacy of institutional arrangements within global society. With respect to transnational accountability, two sets of questions then arise. First, with respect to which entities are there significant accountability gaps? Where are the gaps that I mentioned before? Where do they exist? And what kinds of external accountability could be applicable to these entities? Now, consider the entities conventionally held accountable on a transnational basis. The most prominent, judging from demonstrations, press coverage, even scholarly articles, are major intergovernmental organizations concerned with economic globalization: the European Union, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization, or WTO. These organizations are major targets and a major focus of this conference that's to follow. They certainly have deficiencies in accountability, which people have explored and we're going to explore more. They do not meet democratic standards of accountability as applied in the best functioning democracies of our era. But ironically, these entities seem to me to be relatively accountable compared to other important global actors. They're internally accountable on the basis of authorization and support. They have to be created by states. It's no surprise. The EU, World Bank, IMF, WTO were created by states, and they require continuing financial support from states. They don't have autonomous taxation powers. They require ongoing political support from people in states. Externally, there are significant accountability gaps. Indeed, many poor people affected by the policies of WTO or the World Bank or the IMF have no ability to hold the organizations accountable. Nevertheless, there's a vaguely held view, which is pretty worldwide, that these people should have some say in what these institutions do, that the voices of the poor, in the World Bank's phrase, should be heard. The World Bank itself says the voice of the poor should be heard. That is, many people feel that these organizations should be externally as well as internally accountable. And furthermore, various NGOs purporting to speak for affected people and principles that would help these people gain legitimacy on the basis of this widespread belief that these intergovernmental organizations should be held accountable. And one result of these endeavors, of course, is that the process of decision-making of these multilateral institutions have become much more transparent in the last 5 or 10 years. Indeed, in transparency, they now compare well to the decision-making processes of most governments, and even some democratic governments. When their processes are not, there's no Official Secrets Act for the IMF. When their processes are not transparent, the chief source of non-transparency is governmental pressure for confidentiality. It doesn't come from the staff, but it comes from governments, especially developing country governments. But the decentralization and discord that's characteristic of world politics means that these organizations can't even keep secrets very well. So when the multilateral agreement for investment 4 years ago was torpedoed by NGOs, it was torpedoed because the negotiations were leaked by representatives from two governments involved in the negotiations. At least representatives didn't like what was going on, and they leaked the information. And it's manifest that the leaders of these international organizations spend much of their time trying to answer charges against the organization. They spend an awful lot of time being accountable in the sense of trying to answer the questions that are always raised about the non-accountability of their organizations. They try to persuade people that their organizations are actually both constructive and responsive. So multilateral intergovernmental organizations, such as the World Bank, are anything but out-of-control bureaucracies, accountable to nobody. Indeed, the real problem seems to me to be just the opposite. The organizations are subject to accountability claims from almost everybody. But effective accountability is limited to powerful states. So everyone claims that they should be, that the World Bank should be accountable, but it actually has to be accountable to the United States, the European Union, Japan, and a small number of other wealthy states, and to some extent to poor borrowing states. But it doesn't have to be accountable to NGOs. So there's a discrepancy. The NGOs and other would-be principals demand accountability. But these NGOs are weak compared to the United States government, for example, or the European Union. So the would-be principals, like the NGOs, lose their battle to the real principals, the states, who actually have the authorization and support on their side. So, of course, the NGOs are unhappy, and they condemn the intergovernmental organizations as unaccountable. Their real targets are actually the powerful governments who are doing things the NGOs don't like or supporting policies the NGOs don't approve of. But it's the intergovernmental organizations that are damaged by what you can either call collateral damage or friendly fire from the NGOs. It's ironic. What the controversies indicate is not that the intergovernmental organizations are unaccountable, which is what a superficial reader of the literature would think, but that accountability is a distributional issue, the issue of power once again. The issue is not so much, are these organizations accountable? The issue is, the answer to that question is, yes, they're accountable. They are internally accountable to the states that authorize their creation and that provide financial support. And to a lesser extent, they are externally accountable to NGOs and the media. The real issue is the balance of internal versus external accountability. NGOs make a normative claim for accountability to groups that are affected on the basis of principles such as sustainable development or human rights. In other words, they make external accountability claims based on the impact of these organizations, and these claims compete with the internal accountability claims which governments make based on authorization and support. They're serious issues. But they are not issues of absence of accountability. They're issues of, is it the wrong kind of accountability? Is there too much accountability to governments and too little to NGOs or to people who are affected? That's a real question. It's a serious question. But the notion there that these are unaccountable organizations will not withstand analysis. And the fundamental issue here is that different types of accountability favor different principles and would-be principles. So accountability is not a matter of you should have more of it. It's not like it's better to have more money than less money for the typical economist. No, it's a matter of power. Accountability is a matter of power. It's not having more of it. It's having the right kind of it, and it's a matter of who has it. Now, ironically, it's ironic in light of this analysis that intergovernmental organizations have been the principal targets of people demanding external accountability. And in my view, they're the principal targets because they are weak and visible. It's much more attractive to attack a weak target than a strong target. Anybody knows that. And it's a lot easier to see how these organizations could be reformed. There's been a lot of reform in the last 10 years, actually, than to see how to reform more powerful potential targets, such as the United States government, or the Roman Catholic Church, or ExxonMobil. It seems to me that, in fact, the external accountability gaps that we should be concerned about are greatest with the entities that are not conventionally held accountable on a transnational basis. And I'm going to mention seven such entities now. First, the NGOs themselves. They are, in general, less transparent than the multilateral organizations that they criticize for lack of transparency. Their claims to a voice are based on their representation, virtual representation, of disadvantaged people for whom they claim to speak. I belong to a number of these NGOs, Amnesty, Oxfam, and so on, and I think a lot of them do good work. But they are, in fact, claiming a voice on the basis of not of my membership, on the basis of speaking for disadvantaged people, human rights victims and poor people in the third world, neither of which I am, and also on the basis of the abstract principles that they espouse. But they're actually accountable to people like me, that is, wealthy people in the first world who give money to them and who respond to their appeals, and for whom their activity is largely symbolic politics, because we do not evaluate the results. My only way of evaluating the results of Oxfam or Amnesty, you know, my chief way is to read their own letters and newsletters. So it's not a very good way to evaluate anybody's activity to read their view. So there's a disjunction for the NGOs between the accountability that they claim on the basis of people they virtually represent, and the actual knowledge and situation of people whom they actually represent, whom they depend on for continuing funding. Secondly, multinational corporations. Multinational corporations are held internally accountable, with more or less success, less, I think, recently in the United States than more, to their shareholders, who authorize action and provide support. But their actions, of course, also have enormous effects on other people. The anti-globalization movement is right to be concerned about corporate power, even if its proposed remedies are not always coherent. If we are concerned about the effects of powerful entities on powerless people, we scholars should be asking how to hold corporations accountable, as national governments in capitalist societies have sought to hold corporations accountable internally for over a century. The effects are especially pronounced for media conglomerates, who have particularly great influence, but we haven't focused on them at all. There's very little literature on the accountability of media conglomerates. I haven't looked it up, but I would bet the ratio is at least 10 to 1 and probably 50 to 1 of the accountability of intergovernmental organizations, literature this big, accountability of media conglomerates this big. I think that's more or less reversed relative to the real problems. Thirdly, transgovernmental and private sector networks. Anne-Marie Slaughter's paper, which was going to be given here, talked about that. And she has an interesting paper on the subject. I'm much less sanguine than she is about these networks, the informal networks of security, of securities regulators, or informal networks of central bankers. These seem to be quite unaccountable. They are much more secretive, much less transparent than the World Bank or the IMF. And we haven't paid much attention to them either. Fourth, the Roman Catholic Church. Roman Catholic Church is a secretive, authoritarian structure that is not very accountable to any human institutions or groups. In fact, it denies the validity of a notion of accountability for itself, as its reaction to the pedophile scandal in the United States in the last couple of months indicates so clearly. Fifthly, mass religious movements that don't have hierarchies like the church. Fundamentalist Islamic movements fall into this category. Unlike the church, there is no hierarchical organization to hold accountable. Who holds imams who preach support for terrorism accountable? Sixth, obviously, covert terrorist networks, such as Al-Qaeda. These networks are almost by definition not externally accountable. They do not accept the responsibility of identifying themselves, much less responding to questions or accepting others' rights to sanction them. They cannot be held accountable, although they can be punished. And finally, powerful states. The doctrine of sovereignty has traditionally served to protect states from external accountability. Sovereignty can be interpreted as a way of denying the validity of external accountability for states, although it has not necessarily protected weak states from the depredations of the strong. Multilateral institutions are designed, in fact, to make states accountable to others. That's one function of WTO, is to make the states accountable to one another for their policies, if not to outsiders. Even moderately powerful states, though, can resist external pressure, external accountability on many issues. It has been notably difficult for the United Nations to hold Israel accountable for its actions on the West Bank. Egypt and Saudi Arabia have not been held accountable to the victims of the terrorists whose supporters they have often encouraged. And most of all, extremely powerful states seem virtually immune from accountability if they refuse to accept it. The United States, of course, is the principal case in point. I want to talk now about the external accountability of states. I can't talk about all these entities that I've flung barbs at. Let's talk about states. States are powerful, and they're often not externally accountable. But institutions of multilateralism exist that can hold them accountable on some issues. And if we care about accountability, as I do, we should inquire as to how such institutions could be extended and made more effective. We should begin by recognizing, as Rousseau did, that internal democracy will not assure accountability to outsiders whom the powerful democracy affects. The United States, Israel, and other democracies are internally accountable, but on key issues they are not externally accountable. David Held has astutely pointed out that the external accountability problem may even be greater as a result of democracy. He writes, "Arrogance has been reinforced by the claim of the political elites to derive their support from that most virtuous source of power, the demos. That is, being democratically elected, whether in a flawed election or a non-flawed election, the leaders of democracies believe they're accountable and they're authorized to go and do what their peoples want them to do. But they're not externally accountable. Now, there are three modest mechanisms of external accountability that do apply to states, which I want to mention. First one only applies to weak states. Weak states that depend economically on the decisions of richer countries are subject to demands for fiscal accountability. Albert Hirschman pointed out over half a century ago that foreign trade, when it produces benefits, generates an influence effect, and it generates power for the less dependent partner. Accountability is a power-laden concept. And so the implication of the influence effect is that rich countries that seek to hold poor countries accountable can often do so, especially if they become more generous. That is, the more generous they are, the more aid they provide, the more influence they get in the relationship, and the more accountable they can hold the poor countries. Dramatically increased efforts to increase the benefits that poor countries receive from globalization would create an influence effect, making it easier to hold these countries accountable for their actions. Of course, for the poor countries, such generosity would be problematic, precisely because it would make them more dependent on the rich. So there's external accountability toward poor countries if the rich countries actually give them substantial amounts of support. A second mechanism of external accountability relies on the pockets of institutionalized accountability in world politics, on international institutions, the very multilateral institutions that are maligned by much of the accountability literature. States that are members of regional organizations, such as the European Union, are subject to demands for accountability from their peers. In the various comitology procedures of the Union. And states that have joined organizations such as WTO or the new International Criminal Court are subject to legal accountability with respect to specified activities. Europe, the United States, Japan, and other rich countries are targets of demands for accountability in trade, with their agricultural subsidies and protection of old industries such as steel serving as prominent examples. The extension of some degree of accountability to powerful states through multilateral institutions offers a glimmer of hope. It's not very big, but it's a glimmer of hope. But we should remember, of course, that these powerful states do not accept accountability for its own sake. They resist it. But chiefly, when they accept it because they gain benefits in reciprocity from these institutions. And as recent U.S. policies on steel and agriculture remind us, powerful democratic states display much more internal than external accountability. Even when, as yesterday, the heads of these powerful international organizations, WTO, World Bank, and IMF, all got together to criticize the United States for its agricultural and steel protectionism. And I'm sure, of course, the Bush administration will take it into account tomorrow and immediately repeal those measures. And I'm sure Bush will veto the agricultural bill as a result of the appeal from these powerful organizations. The most general form of accountability in world politics is reputational. Indeed, it's the only form of external accountability that appears to constrain the United States with respect to its political military activities. Reputation is double-edged, since states may seek reputations for being tough as well as for being reliable partners. And the lack of institutionalization of reputational concerns makes reputation a relatively unreliable source of constraint. Yet reputational accountability has one potential significance, because reputations of states matter for their other activities. To be effective, states have to be included in the relevant networks of actors. And reputational accountability, then, weak though it is significant. On any given issue, the United States can act unilaterally, dismissing demands for external accountability. Indeed, one of my themes, as you've heard, is the weakness of external as opposed to internal accountability in world politics, especially as far as powerful states are concerned. However, the United States has many objectives in the world, some of which require voluntary cooperation from others. It would be impossible for the United States to coerce other states on the basis on all issues of concern to it. Failing to cooperate with others leads them to retaliate in one form or another, following practices of reciprocity, as the Europeans are about to retaliate on steel and trade policy. More diffusely, damage to the U.S. reputation as a potential cooperator reduces the incentives for others to cooperate with the United States in anticipation of cooperation on some other issues in the future. Most generally, any country playing a long-term leadership role in global governance has a long-term interest in the legitimacy of global governance, as well as in its own status as a leader. To any sensible U.S. administration, such concerns for leadership would be a constraint and a reason to let itself be held accountable to some extent on other issues. So I've pointed to three sources of external accountability: the need of poor countries for aid, institutionalization in international organizations, and reputational concerns arising from multiple issues for powerful states, such as the United States. None of these is very strong vis-a-vis powerful states. But please note that all three sources of external accountability are augmented by globalization. They're augmented by globalization. Globalization, as the anti-globalization movement has emphasized, may weaken internal accountability within democracies, but it's a condition for external accountability. If the United States weren't tied up in a lot of different issues with a lot of different countries on whom it depends, if it weren't for globalization, it would have almost no reason to let itself be held accountable externally. So when you hear the next time you hear that globalization reduces accountability, stick in the word internal in there, because it magnifies external accountability. And if external accountability is the more serious problem than internal accountability, then globalization may be part of the solution and not part of the problem. Here's another irony. Opponents of globalization often raise the issue of accountability as an argument against globalization. But they're thinking of a largely imaginary bygone world in which states really controlled their borders and in which democratic governments regulated domestic activities through democratic means. This is a totally imaginary world. It's fictitious, and it's laughable when you hear people talk about the United States or Britain 50 years ago as being like this. Their imaginary world is the United States during the New Deal as they would have liked it to evolve without the inconveniences of Nazism, fascism, communism, World War II, and the Cold War. That is, the imaginary world of good, progressive, social democratic liberals like my parents in 1937, that's the world that we're having the real world compared with, thank you. And that the world never existed, and it doesn't exist now. In fact, the choice is not globalization or not, but I think the choice is between relatively legitimate globalization with a measure of democratic and pluralistic external accountability, which we should be working for, and illegitimate globalization without such accountability. Having said all of this, it will nevertheless be naive to believe that the United States will be easy to hold externally accountable. Indeed, for the United States to be held accountable, internal accountability will have to supplement external accountability rather than substituting for it. Those of its own people, those happy few of us, given the public opinion polls, who are sensitive to world politics, will have to demand it, both on the grounds of self-interest and with respect to American values. In view of contemporary American public attitudes, this hortatory comment does not necessarily offer much hope, at least in the short run. Indeed, my ironic conclusion is that with respect to external accountability, the two sworn enemies, Al-Qaeda and the United States, have a great deal in common. They have in common their relative lack of accountability compared to other actors, most other actors in world politics. Well, let me close with six summary observations. I've said enough to offend everybody now. The observations mix empirical and normative statements. First, those of us who would like to see greater democratic and pluralistic accountability, and I'm one of them, must recognize that global society, while real, will not become universal in the foreseeable future. The existence of widespread malign agency, bad people out there, evil, ensures Evil's a real word, although I'm not the axis of evil, but evil. Ensures that powerful states seeking to control territory will continue to assert themselves. Cosmopolitan democracy is a distant ideal, not a feasible option for our time. Second, we should demand more external accountability of powerful entities engaged in various forms of global governance. Intergovernmental organizations and weak dependent states are most easily held accountable, and the most attention has been spent on holding them accountable, and the most words have been devoted to thinking about how to make them accountable. We cannot expect to hold shadowy terrorist movements accountable, but we should pay more attention to the accountability of NGOs, corporations, religious organizations, and movements, and powerful states. Thirdly, to hold powerful states accountable, the world needs more multilateral governance, not less. Indeed, one of my concerns about claims that intergovernmental organizations are not accountable is that weakening intergovernmental organizations will give powerful governments more ability simply to act as they please, because one of the few places where they're called even modestly to account is in the context of international organizations. More interdependence also would help by reinforcing reputational incentives to accept accountability. Both institutionalization and interdependence with its reputational accountability depend on globalization. Therefore, globalization promotes external accountability. Fourth, the United States especially needs to be held accountable because its internal democracy cannot be counted on to defend the interests of weak peoples whom American action may harm. Not new, no democracy has ever been particularly friendly toward weak peoples whom it can push around. Yet it's very difficult to hold the United States accountable, since one dimension of power is that it protects the power holder from accountability. It's part of power. 9/11 implies more concentration of power and more state action. As a result, the world is further from the ideal of transnational accountability now than most of us recognized before 9/11. Fifth, if we recognize that powerful states pose the most serious threats to accountability in world politics, states, not the World Bank, IMF, and WTO, we will see that well-meaning efforts to demand, quote, more accountability, unquote, from international organizations can be problematic or self-defeating. As I have argued, more accountable also often means accountable to NGOs and advocacy networks rather than just to governments. Certainly, some real benefits could result from making the WTO and the IMF more accountable to a wider range of interests and values. But we should be alert to the prospect that the political result of such a shift would have two other effects. One would be to increase the weight of rich countries, which, as Eric Woods has argued, have the advocacy networks and the lawyers and the lobbying firms. So if you open up WTO to more civil society, you're opening it up to rich civil society, which is not surprising that the developing countries don't want to do that. Secondly, if states get less benefit from international institutions, if we well-meaningly put these institutions under more pressure or put the states under more pressure, they may be less willing to provide resources and support and to accept demands on them through these institutions for accountability. So we may get more accountability of less and less important multilateral institutions while the states get off scot-free and have less accountability imposed on them. The ultimate result of such well-meaning moves, therefore, could be a weakening of the accountability, limited as it is, that multilateralism imposes on powerful states. Finally, in the long run, global governance will only be legitimate if there is a substantial measure of external accountability, a firm advocate of external accountability. Global governance helps the powerful most of all because they shape it. In their long run self-interest, therefore, powerful states such as the United States should accept a measure of accountability, despite their inclinations to the contrary. As in 1776, Americans should display what the Declaration of Independence refers to as a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Our principal task as scholars and citizens who believe in more accountability is to build support within our powerful rich countries for acceptance of more effective and legitimate multilateral governance to achieve human purposes, and for the increased external accountability that is likely to follow. Thank you for listening. I look forward to your questions and to the debate.
Well,
we can agree it wasn't the word of God or the devil, but it was certainly damn good. So the floor is open, and we'll take questions, I think, today, one at a time. I usually take clusters, but I think today we'll take one at a time. So show your hands.
Yes.
Hi. There's been some growing concern, particularly in the IPE literature, of private and technical authorities such as the International Securities Market Association, and they fall outside of this multilateral institutional framework that you've set out in your speech. Where do they fit into the mixed society system paradigm that you've outlined, and how can they be held accountable?
It's a good question. I refer to them briefly. I didn't talk about them much because in this conference there was a paper prepared on these governmental networks, or transgovernmental networks, as they're called. Is this working? How's that? Okay. By Anne-Marie Slaughter, who couldn't come at the last minute. My view is that these networks principally operate within what I call global society. That is, they don't extend very much to those entities and groups that don't share common values and institutions. So they're mostly within the area of complex interdependence called them. I'm very dubious about their accountability, because it seems to me they tend to be more closed, less transparent, informal, which means that outsiders can't figure out what happened. And that compared to the formal intergovernmental organizations, which some people think they are supplanting, they have a much greater accountability gap.
Do you agree with Louis Pauly's assessment then the IMF serves as a buffer between debtor and creditor nations?
I think that the IMF, the first thing to realize about the IMF is that it is dominated by the rich countries. This is not rocket science. They provide the funding, and all you have to do is look up the formal voting arrangements, right? The U.S. has, what, 17-something percent. The Europeans have 30-odd percent. And small, poor countries have de minimis. So I wouldn't have used the word buffer. Except in a qualified way. That is, I think the IMF has to respond to some extent to the poor countries' demands, partly because of the ideology which it's based on, and partly because they have to implement their plans, and the power of the poor countries is the power to sabotage implementation and to renege. So I would agree with the buffer language if one accepts it in the context of an organization dominated so heavily by the rich that it's one-sided. If the buffer language implies equality, some sort of symmetrical interdependence, I would say it's misleading.
Would you accept that the world needs two or three superpowers to have a better to create a climate of accountability? What I mean is that counterbalance, because during the time that Russia and America were the two superpowers, the world was a much safer place than what it is now.
No, I wouldn't, because I don't think it was a safer place, or that the two or three superpowers were more accountable. There's rarely been a less accountable actor than the Soviet Union of the Brezhnev era. And those of us who lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis know that it wasn't a very safe place. It's only in retrospect that we survived it, but in fact, the more one learns about that crisis, the more dangerous it looked, not the less dangerous. I was in Cuba in February and was shocked by new information I was told there about how close Castro was to actually having control of missiles and using them. So I don't think it's a solution to the problem to have more than one superpower. Either a single superpower or having two or three superpowers generates accountability.
A lot of the literature with regards to globalization prior to September 11th talked on or emphasized the I would say, even independent power of transnational forces, especially technology and the economy. Even Anthony Giddens saw these as the two main forces behind the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, you mentioned that these forces are very largely non-accountable, but simultaneously you also saw a greater increase in the power of rich and powerful states. My question is, to what extent do you think that powerful and also medium-sized nation states can harness transnational forces such as technology such as economy to the increasement of their power, and to what extent are these powers really independent?
Okay, I think that there's a good deal that, well, I'm going to be a little more optimistic than what I said in my speech. That is, if one wants to look for openings, let's talk about openings for accountability. And if one were running a small or middle-sized state, you'd be concerned about how to make the United States more, for example, more accountable, or how to make the European Union more accountable, whether you're in or outside of it. And I think that one of the sets of ideas which runs in direct on your side is the fact that this is a democratic era, and therefore very few people are willing to say explicitly that they should not be accountable. We shouldn't have said that is accountability is a positive value, whereas 200 years ago, most people in the world would have not even recognized the word, much less thought it was that. So that what I would do if I were, and I'm urging people here to do too, it seems to me that both small states and citizens of big states ought to demand that there be accountability externally. But they need to demand it in a realistic way. That is, they can't simply expect that, for example, it can't be the case that accountability means that everybody has equal voice in the IMF. That's unrealistic given the size of different countries and the power realities of the world. So the trick is, how do you move incrementally toward more external accountability with still under the constraints that we know that world politics and inequality in world politics imposes?
This is already related to some of the comments you made, but I was wondering, well, I understand the distinction between internal and external accountability, but at some point, would you agree that they're merged together, or the absence of external accountability will at some point undermine internal accountability, or what we can call an internal reputation or an internal legitimacy problem? Going back to your example on the EU, for instance, its lack of external accountability on issues of immigration actually do relate to some internal accountability issues, given the number of immigrants living in European countries. I wanted to get your opinions on that.
That's a really good question. Broaden that a little bit. Take the easy part first, which is not what you asked. I think an absence of internal accountability undermines any external accountability. It's hard to imagine an entity which is not internally very accountable, being consistently externally accountable, except in response to pressure, or power pressure. Does the absence of external accountability undermine internal accountability? I wish I thought it did. If that were true, there would be more resonance in the United States now. The worldwide demands for accountability from the United States, from Europe and elsewhere, have never been stronger. And the support for unilateralist administration in the United States has never been stronger. So what I would hope for is that there were some complementarity, that there'd be some resonance of the external accountability complaints internally. Now, we saw that in the World Bank and IMF. Because they were weak organizations, they had to respond. World Bank stopped holding dams. IMF and World Bank put a lot of more information on their websites. They became more transparent. They talked the accountability game. And I think actually have moved to become more accountable. But it's because they're so weak that if they hadn't done that and they lost public support in the rich countries or support in the poor countries, they'd be finished. Now, the problem is, for a very powerful act like the United States, the only way that can happen would be if Americans feel that they should have this decent respect for the opinions of mankind, which the founders of the country claimed to have. And in that case, they would start searching their souls about American policy if it's so uniformly opposed by people. It doesn't bother me at all as an American that people who don't share common values oppose us. Right? I don't get shaken a bit in my beliefs by the fact that Osama bin Laden hates us. Probably just reinforces my my belief in U.S. policy and U.S. actions. But when people who share common values but have a different perspective are so widely opposed, it ought to bring, it ought to be brought home to American elites and then the American public. It'll happen in a two-step fashion. Hasn't happened yet. We can hope it will.
Can you keep your questions brief now, since we've got just 10 more minutes?
I work for one of your unaccountable NGOs, and we're working directly on accountability of global organisations, NGOs, TNCs and intergovernmental organisations. And you talked about the need to strengthen multilateral organisations to boost accountability. And I guess my question is, how do we do that when the stronger states really want to undermine or use the multilateral organisations as a shield? Take the Security Council and what happened in Rwanda. The UN is blamed for what happened in Rwanda, and yet really that was discussions in the Security Council between the states and Europe. So how do we reform those multilateral organizations and make them stronger rather than weaken them further?
The multilateral organizations are weak, but they have one great advantage in that they are forums, public forums, where criticism cannot be prevented and is legitimate. So that if you look at the UN, it's a very weak organization in terms of action. But the United States, it's probably the place where the United States has been criticized most severely, most consistently, most publicly over the last 50 years. And it provides a forum and a focal point for critique. So that's the necessary condition for accountability. It's not sufficient. But if you didn't have it, there'd be less pressure. WTO, which has a stronger mandate than the UN has, is the only place where effectively, or it's the most effective locale for holding the U.S. accountable for its recent steel policy, for example. Take that concrete example. And WTO actually promotes accountability in this sense because it gives the Europeans, and anybody else, but Europeans especially, the right to retaliate in material ways that adversely affect the United States. So it institutionalizes reciprocity. And it prohibits the United States beyond a certain point from re-retaliating. If you didn't have WTO, the most powerful state puts on arbitrary tariffs and says to everybody else, if you dare to say a word about it, we're going to double them, or we're going to put on tariffs on somebody else, so keep quiet. Can't do that. They have to destroy the whole WTO to do that. So they're not very serious limits, but if you compare them with the reality that would exist or did exist before international institutions existed, they're better.
My question relates to the previous one. On the one hand, you said that we should strengthen the multilateral institutions. On the other hand, you said that powerful states are difficult to control. Now, that to me raises the issue of a conflict between rationality, or if you like, self-interest, and rule following. Now, how do we reconcile these two? How do we make powerful states to obey international rules?
General view on this, a very good question, is that I have never thought it was very wise to rely on any states, powerful or weak, to behave altruistically. And I don't think that it does much good to call on states to behave altruistically. I mean, one can also go and shout into the void if you feel like it, but it doesn't have much instrumental value, in my opinion. And I've always regarded working in the United Nations that did that as empty preaching, empty moralism. So I believe that the most important thing is to try to, I think the best you can hope is that states will behave according to an enlightened conception of their self-interest, what I once called non-myopic self-interest. What I was calling for at the end of my talk was for the United States not to become altruistic. I think that's not going to happen, and it's not reasonable even to ask of a state. But for it, in a large scale at least, but for the United States to become more consistent and far-sighted in its own self-interest. If we want a world which is governed with a considerable degree of rules and rule obedience, and a world in which we can use persuasion instead of coercion and bargaining to get a lot of things we want, and if we believe, as I do, that the liberal democracies have the best set up political institutions around, and therefore that persuasion is going to be on our side, going to help us because we have a better case than anybody else, then you want a world which promotes persuasion. And that means accepting yourself being accountable. So it means sacrificing some gain in the short term but not because you're altruistic, but because in the long term you think that's going to benefit you and the values you care about.
Time just for one last question, I'm afraid.
Yes, I was wondering if you could reiterate your position on whether or not you believe there's a neo-Gramscian trans national capitalist class, and whether or not you think that could be the root of a lot of the external inaccountability in the world, especially in regards to finance, capital flows, those sorts of things.
Well, it's good it's the last question because we can stay until about 4 o'clock or whatever. Let me interpret different ways in which one might talk about a neo-Gramscian capitalist class. If you talk about it as a narrowly defined set of people who are defined in terms of their relationships to the means of production, for example, the owners or the controllers of major capitalist groups, I think that it's not the source of our most fundamental problems. There certainly are such elites, and they have some common interests. But I'm much more concerned, if you're talking about it in a neo-Gramscian way, about the influence of a set of ideas or a set of ruling ideas, I don't really think they come that monolithically. And I certainly don't, I mean, anybody in my other life, I have occasion to sometimes interact with people who would normally be considered as part of the world capitalist class. And I've never seen them as the major source of ideas. So I think those are somewhat separate. I think they're inequalities of power, and there's some people who wield tremendous amounts of power. There are global movements of ideas, but I think, as Sikic and others have shown, and the human rights movement has shown, some of the most powerful sets of ideas that have swept over the world in the last 20 years were certainly not ideas that were generated by this capitalist class, such as human rights. Now, neoliberalism is consistent with the view of these people. So I think that I would say that I would call it an elite, but if you want to call it a class, I don't really care. If you talk about sets of elites which are fairly tightly linked and they have sets of interests which are interested in maintaining a certain kind of system, yes. But I don't see them as those entities that kind of rule our minds. And I see them as powerful, but only among a whole set of other actors who are powerful, including the statist actors who are often at odds with these people.
Well, I need to make two or three brief announcements. Before I do, let me just abuse my position and ask you two questions, just very briefly. You've got just 30 seconds to answer them. One is, could there be a danger in overstating the significance of 9/11? I just wonder, because it seems to me that you can read, let's say, changes in Islam after 9/11 and risk overstating the lack of hospitality or lack of capacity to reconcile with secular conceptions of power, human rights traditions, and democracy if you take 9/11 as the main focus point. But let's be clear that certain forms of radical fundamentalism are fairly new. They can be traced back probably 30, 40 years. Islam has a very honorable tradition of existing side by side with different cultures, civilizations, religions, and so on. So I worry about reading a fundamental clash of values and civilizations into 9/11. That's the first question. And I'm just interested in how you'd respond to that. The second one is, can you give us some reasons for hope about that one rogue power, the United States? Are there, as a political economist now, are there any structural reasons for thinking that the U.S. might become more receptive or has to accommodate itself to the strengthening of multilateral institutions? I mean, you might say that in 1945, in the post-1945 world, the U.S. emerged as the great superpower. It was hegemonic in many fundamental respects. But if we trace what's happened to the U.S. economy in the last few decades, it's certainly more open and therefore more vulnerable to the global economy in some senses than it's been before. So are there structural reasons which might point to the Bush administration being a bad moment of reaction and may suggest, give us reasons for thinking that if not the Bush administration, the administrations afterwards will return to the fold and commitment in deepening multilateral institutions?
Thanks. There's always a danger after a major event of overstating it. That certainly there is. There's also a danger of understating it, and I've been struck in the international relations meetings I've been to recently how little it's been talked about. How people are acting as if it's a one-time occurrence. I don't think it is a one-time occurrence. Behaving as if it's an earthquake or something that sort of happened then. We just have to stick it into our model somewhere. So there's a danger of overstating it. There's also a danger of understating it. I was very, very careful in my talk not to say anything about Islam as such being a clash of I was not endorsing a clash of civilizations view. Since Huntington uses it, I talked about fundamentalism, and I mentioned three different traditions in which there's fundamentalism. And one was an obvious reference to settlers on the West Bank, and probably people probably picked that up. And your Mormons are another example, probably, or some of them at least. So this is fundamentalism, not Islam, that I'm worried about. It's a certain kind of interpretation of revealed religion and access to a truth that makes one willing to override the rights of others who don't seem to have access to that same truth. Now, the second question, I think there are reasons for hope, and I'm going to give two. The first is the one that you alluded to. It's actually remarkable. I mean, there are lots of things about the WTO I don't like. I'm an environmentalist, and I don't like a lot of the WTO rules in the environment. I don't like the TRIPS agreement. I go on and on about WTO and where it's gone wrong. But it's extraordinary that the United States, at the very time, at the very height of its power, right after the Cold War, agreed to WTO, which involves binding on the United States to binding legal restraints on the U.S. policy. I'm seen as a wild institutionalist who believes in international institutions, but I don't know if Miles, if you thought so, but 1985, if you'd asked me, will the Uruguay round wind up with a WTO with binding dispute settlement, legally binding on the United States, and forcible through reciprocity, I would have said, what are you smoking? Please take my course. And that I think was a result principally of this kind of interdependence. That is, the striking change in the United States and trade policy in the last 40 years is that 40 years ago, although consumers benefited from liberal trade, the concentrated producers, or 50 years ago, the concentrated producers were protectionist because they feared import competition. Now, the concentrated interests are all multinational firms, and they're all pro free trade. So Bush, in fact, is running a risk with his own constituency. In fact, the Marxist, at least, ruling capitalist class is not in favor of protection. So there's a case where that's really opposed to the kind of status. So I think in the long run, the fact that 27%, roughly, last time I looked, of U.S. GDP is kind of caused by imports, but that's as opposed to 7% in 1946, roughly, which has much proportionally. That's going to count in the long run. The second thing, a little more self-interested, I believe that multilateral institutions are not only that worthwhile, but I believe they're important for states, and they're useful for states. And I believe that states dismiss or ignore them wantonly at their peril. Not that states have to sign up to any random international organization that somebody dreams up, but that a policy of consistent negativism toward international organizations and a consistent attempt to restore sovereignty, like Undersecretary Bolton has long espoused, will backfire because it'll lead to less ability to exercise influence. And every great power feels it doesn't have enough influence over external events, even if everybody else thinks it has too much. And the United States will find, if it doesn't use multilateral institutions, that it's tying its own hand with respect to influence and persuasion. And sooner or later, this will become evident. Not during a war on terrorism so gallantly carried out by us.
Thank you. Well, there are just three points I would like to make just to wind it up. First of all, I'd like to point out to you that there's this another Miliband lecture on the same theme on the 6th of June at 6:30 here. John Ruggie, former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, now professor at Harvard, will be talking again on global governance, but exploring the corporate connection. That will be his main theme, the corporate connection. So the 6th of June at 6:30. Secondly, there are a few people here who are attending this closed workshop and conference. I'm emphasizing the word closed, I'm afraid. This closed workshop and conference that follows this lecture. Please could you stay behind afterwards so we can just usher you to the next room. And finally, it just remains for me to thank our speaker very, very much indeed.